This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, January the 27th, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, demonstrators take to the streets in Yemen as protests continue in Egypt. A US government commission says the economic crisis was avoidable. And supporters of detained US soldier Bradley Manning claim his treatment in prison amounts to torture. Those stories and more, but first, these news briefs. I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco.
I'm Jess Burns with news briefs for Free Speech Radio News. A victory today for Bushmen in Botswana. An appeals court in the southern African country ruled the group does have the right to drill for water in the Kalahari Desert. Last summer, the Botswana government denied the Bushmen access to their water well in the Kalahari Game Reserve. The Bushmen have been fighting the Botswana government for nearly a decade to retain rights to their ancestral home. A Ugandan gay rights activist is dead today, beaten to death. David Kato received international attention last year after suing a local newspaper that outed a group of allegedly gay Ugandans. Homosexuality is severely penalized in Uganda, and anti-gay sentiment runs high. Kato was an outspoken campaigner against a proposed law that would have punished homosexual acts with the death penalty. He spoke to the Dutch group Start to Wish last year.
Will Uganda be able to understand the faith-based hate behind the bill? There's the faith hate base, which is causing a genocide might come up. We're going to die.
The gay rights advocacy group Sexual Minorities Uganda condemned the killing, saying Kato had been receiving death threats since his photo had been published. Some gay rights advocates blame U.S.-based evangelicals for sowing the seeds of hate within the country. Civil liberties groups in Great Britain are speaking out against a new round of anti-terrorism measures announced by the government. From London, FSRN's George Lavender reports.
This week, the Home Secretary announced new anti-terrorism powers. The Terrorism Prevention and Investigation Measures, or TPIMS, will replace the controversial control orders, under which terror suspects can be held under house arrest without charge. Under TPIM, the Home Secretary can limit a suspect's freedom on the advice of the Secret Service. That order can be challenged in the courts, but the secret evidence behind it cannot be seen by the suspect. Anyone subject to the new controls will be confined to their house at night for up to 10 hours and have to wear an electronic tag. Asim Qureshi is Executive Director of Cage Prisoners, a human rights organisation that campaigns to provide due process for those detained or killed as part of the global war on terror.
The question, you know, has to be asked, is this really for our benefit, or is this just to kind of perpetuate a climate of fear that will keep people thinking that, oh, there are many, many dangerous terrorists out there. I think they made the country an even more dangerous place by showing people that they're willing to remove due process and human rights.
Critics say that the new measures are just a rebranding of the old system. George Lavender, FSRN, London.
Haiti's ruling party has withdrawn support for its leading presidential candidate, Jude Celestin. Celestin has been at the middle of a storm of criticism surrounding last November's failed elections. He finished second, but wide popular sentiment amid allegations of voting irregularities was that he should have finished lower in the polls and not advanced to the runoff. Today's withdrawal of support could ease political tension in Haiti, but Celestin has not indicated he will drop out of the race. The Texas State Senate has passed a law requiring voters to show a photo ID in order to vote. It passed along partisan lines.
Members, there being 19 ayes and 11 nays, Senate Bill 14 is finally passed.
With all Republicans supporting the bill. Democrats say the measure targets left-leaning voters and may not pass the scrutiny of the Voting Rights Act. It now goes to the State House, where a Republican majority is expected to support it. And that's news briefs for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. Thousands of anti-government protesters filled the streets of Yemen's capital Sana'a today, many wearing pink scarves and hats, a symbolic colour for this popular uprising. Demonstrators are calling for President Ali Abdullah Saleh to step down after more than 30 years in power. One opposition activist told Al Jazeera that he's hopeful the government will enact meaningful policy changes.
These people are protesting for economic and political reform, which we've agreed on with the government. There is still an opportunity, but we are afraid we will reach the point of no return.
Several people were injured, but media reports describe the Yemen rallies as peaceful. Demonstrations took place in several parts of the capital, with youth and opposition activists calling for lower prices, more jobs, and less corruption. Some of the same issues that have led tens of thousands to the streets in Tunisia and Egypt. In Cairo, protests continued throughout the night, and some describe violent encounters with police. At least four protesters have been killed, as well as one police officer. Aram Online reporter Lina El-Wardani, who herself was beaten and detained, said police attacked a group of about 300 mostly young people last night in the capital. A poet and filmmaker were also beaten, and the Associated Press says police broke the cheekbone of one of their photographers. Amateur video shows crowds of people running from security forces and some youth throwing rocks at a line of riot police. Another video depicts a group of men in dark clothing dragging a protester along the ground. One of them kicks the protester, and another pulls him underneath an overhang, out of the camera's sight. Some protesters started fires and hundreds have been detained. For more on the protests, FSRN's Lillian Boktor spoke to Cairo-based journalist and blogger Hossam El Hamalawi. He predicted protests will continue until President Mubarak leaves the country.
The country has been witnessing its strongest protests in its history since 1977, where tens of thousands of Egyptians have taken to the streets, both in the capital and in the provinces, north and south, in order to ask and demand that Hosni Mubarak goes and leaves Egypt's rule immediately. Protesters were also chanting against police brutality and state security police, which is Mubarak's Gestapo. They were also chanting, demanding political change, social justice. And for hours and hours, they clashed with the security forces in several parts of Cairo. And the protests yesterday reached their climax when thousands of protesters occupied downtown Tahrir Square, which is the biggest square in Cairo, for hours, battling the police, trying to storm the parliament, until the police managed to gain control once again of downtown using rubber bullets and using tear gas. These tear gas canisters that were thrown heavily on the protesters yesterday were made in the U.S. And this is not a coincidence. Our regime is the second largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid after Israel. We receive $1.5 billion a year from the Obama administration, $1.3 billion out of which goes into Mubarak's military. But these protests present hope for us that this U.S.-backed dictatorship is going to fall soon, and Mubarak will be joining Ben Ali, hopefully, in Jeddah.
Hossam, there's been efforts and attempts to try and have protests and uprising like this for many years. Mubarak's been in power for 30 years. What's different now? What happened yesterday? And what was different and who was actually on the street protesting?
Well, what's different is that yesterday basically were the biggest protests ever organized against the Mubarak's dictatorship since he rose to power in 1981. We've never had it that strong. Number two, those who participated in yesterday's mini-intifada, as we are dubbing it here in Egypt, have been ordinary citizens, not necessarily activists or politicized middle-class people. I'm talking about ordinary people here. Thirdly, it's about the scope and the geographic scope of the events. There is hardly a single province yesterday that did not witness an anti-Mubarak protest. So all of these are signs that the regime has been cornered in a way that it was not used to be before.
What is these people's daily reality that they're protesting? What are the conditions on the ground in Egypt that people can't take anymore and have taken to the streets to protest against?
you're talking about an unemployment rate which government claims to be only 9%, but in reality it's much, much higher than that. University graduates cannot find jobs. Poor people cannot find jobs. The prices of basic commodities have been rising steadily over the past years thanks to the neoliberal reforms enacted by the Egyptian government under the blessing of the IMF and the World Bank. I'm talking about a national minimum wage that in Egypt stayed stagnant from 1984 till this year, and it didn't exceed $5 a month. And after lawsuits and protests and strikes, the government only raised it to 400 Egyptian pounds a month. So I'm talking here about a reality which is very dire. The economic situation is something, and in order to add to the grievances of the Egyptians, we have a security apparatus that's extremely brutal in the daily, and it's so intrusive in the daily lives of the Egyptians. Our police is one of the most notorious police forces in the region, although it's hailed, of course, by the Americans and by the Westerners for their so-called counter-terrorism expertise. But in the daily lives of the Egyptians, the police officer plays a tormenting role where torture victims are mainly ordinary citizens, not political activists. And in every single police station in Egypt, you name one, and there are always tons of cases where people have died in custody or have been ill-treated. So these are the realities that the Egyptians are protesting against since yesterday.
There's been reports that over 800 people have been arrested since yesterday. What have you heard about this, and what's the reality on the street of the repression of the police towards the protesters?
The police used iron fist tactics that we are used to, by meaning that sending plainclothes informers to beat and kidnap activists from the streets. Of course, the excessive use of tear gas and baton sticks against the protesters. There are roughly 200 of the detainees have been transported to the notorious facility located in east of Cairo in Nasr City, which is home to the headquarters of the state security police in Egypt. And they are locked up over there. Others have been transferred to other police stations around the capital and in the provinces. Many of them have been injured in the process since they were either beaten up or shot at by rubber bullets. Regarding legal help, the lawyers have not managed to gain access to all the detainees yet. And as we're speaking now, the arrest campaign continues. I am getting every few minutes news about arrests, whether they are in Tanta, whether they are in Mahalla in the Nile Delta, or whether they are here in Cairo among the protesters.
That was Cairo-based journalist and blogger Hossam El Hamalawi, who spoke to FSRN's Lillian Boktor yesterday. More demonstrations are planned for Friday, and many are welcoming the arrival of opposition leader Mohamed El Baradei, who some want to see as the country's president. FSRN has experienced some trying times recently. Funding shortfalls nearly took us off the air. But because of you, our listeners, FSRN has survived. Your generous donations have saved this newscast from the brink. Thanks. But the fight is not over. FSRN staff will continue to offer scaled-back programming through January while we develop our long-term sustainable strategy. That's where you come in. Please help our sustainability fund by visiting fsrn.org. Supporters of Bradley Manning continue to raise concerns about his detention. He's been held at a military prison in Quantico, Virginia since July, when he was charged with illegally accessing and transferring classified information. But a trial date has not been set, and his attorney alleges he's been mistreated. Jeff Patterson is from the Bradley Manning Support Network. He's a former US Marine and Gulf War resister who was court-martialed and jailed for 3 months. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Great to have the opportunity to talk to you.
You're in regular contact with Manning's attorney, David Coombs, and others who visit him. After 8 months in detention, nearly six of those in Quantico, what are they telling you about Bradley Manning's physical and mental condition?
Well, there's two answers. One is Bradley is very much aware of the growing public support on his behalf, and that is definitely encouraging him a great deal, and he appreciates the visitors are allowed to cut through the red tape and actually get in to see him. But what most people are talking about is the solitary confinement and the multitude of military regulations that they're using as an excuse to submit him to pretty extreme pretrial punishment. 8 months of solitary, 8 months of basically what they call prevention of injury status, which allows them to bar him from any meaningful physical exercise, to not have any comforts like a pillow or a sheet, to allow the guards or even compel the guards to harass him every 5 minutes of every day to make sure that he has not harmed himself in the previous 4 minutes and 59 seconds. And these amount to a form of torture when they go on for 8 months.
Bradley Manning's lawyers share your concerns and say he's been held in maximum custody and last week filed what's called an Article 138 to protest against this and other ways Manning is allegedly being treated. They sent that to the Quantico base commander. Is that referring to the solitary confinement?
Well, for a long time now, we've been dealing with military doublespeak because we describe Manning's situation as being in solitary confinement because that's what's happening. He is not allowed any social interaction with inmates. He stares at a guard for some period of day, but guards do not talk to him except to bark, "Are you okay? Are you okay?" every 5 minutes because that's what they're ordered to do. So he has no social interaction. He is in confinement in this cell 23 hours a day, and that's based on the military doesn't call it solitary confinement. The military calls it maximum confinement. He's the only prisoner at Quantico under maximum confinement. But in addition to the maximum designation, the military also has a prevention of injury status. And again, Bradley is the only prisoner at Quantico under prevention of injury status. And put the two together, it means that they're allowed to subject him to extreme pretrial punishment. Prevention of injury status keeps him from having any personal items in his cell. He cannot have a pen or a pencil except for a one-hour supervised period of the day, assuming that he could poke himself with a pen or pencil, for example. He can only have one book at a time. And I think what Bradley complains about the most is he's not allowed to exercise in his cell. The cell he's kept in 23 hours a day, he can't do push-ups, he can't do sit-ups. If he tries to do that, the guard will order him to stop because he, under this prevention of injury status, he could possibly hurt himself doing a push-up or a sit-up.
The military denies that Bradley Manning is being mistreated. A Defense Department spokesperson, Jeff Morrill, said that Manning is not in solitary confinement or in isolation, but that he's a maximum custody detainee in a prevention of injury status, and he's not on suicide watch, and that he's not being treated differently to any other prisoner. But you dispute that. Could you just explain that discrepancy?
Well, Bradley Manning is the only prisoner at Quantico under maximum confinement. Bradley Manning is the only prisoner under prevention of injury status. And in retaliation for a protest of 150 people last week to rally for him at Quantico, the commander arbitrarily decided that he was a suicide risk and up for 48 hours did place him on suicide watch. That allowed the military to take away his clothing and to take away his eyeglasses. If you put all these regulations together, it amounts to an extreme form of punishment that no other military prisoner, probably in the entire military justice confinement system, is being subjected to.
How difficult is it to even visit Manning?
Well, it's very difficult. David House is a friend of Manning's before all this happened. On Sunday of this week, he was detained, interrogated by the military police, and held until visiting hours are over to ensure that he was not allowed to visit Bradley. So it's always been difficult, but now the military is ratcheting up that, and I believe they're trying to increase Bradley's isolation.
A former commander of the detention center where Manning is actually being held, David McMichael, sent a letter this week to the current commander of the Marine Corps questioning the legality of the conditions under which Manning's being held. Can you tell us if there's been any response to that?
Well, the best response that we've seen is the commander of the Marine Corps Brig at Quantico, where Bradley is being held, was replaced this week. Chief Warrant Officer Everhart, who we've been directing our protest to, was replaced by another Chief Warrant Officer. We're hoping that Denise Barnes, now relooks at Manning's situation and actually does the right thing and places him in a normal confinement status.
If a trial of Manning does go ahead, what are your concerns about that trial?
Our primary concern about the upcoming hearings is that by law, they should be open to the public and supporters. But the military appears to consider the evidence in question, the evidence that was released by WikiLeaks to the public on the internet, still secret. So that if the military gets their way, they'll be allowed to shut the military court-martial hearings to the public and to the media based on their allegations that the public information is still secret.
Jeff Patterson from the Bradley Manning Support Network, thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Awesome. Great to talk to you.
The Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission has concluded that the US economic crisis was avoidable and that the government was not ready to deal with a financial catastrophe of its kind. Today, the commission released its final report. Over the past year and a half, the 10-member commission interviewed more than 700 witnesses and held 19 days of public hearings. Commissioner John Thompson said regulatory failure was a major cause of the 2008 crisis.
Unquestionably, in our minds, there were actions that could have been taken by regulators that would have forestalled or mitigated the impact of this crisis. The Federal Reserve was clearly the steward of lending standards in this country. They chose not to act. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York certainly could have reined in what was being done in some of the large money center banks in New York. I mean, on and on and on. Regulator after regulator, they either chose not to act or turned a blind eye to what was actually going on. So it's less about a particular individual than a systemic sense of deregulation and inaction by those who were empowered to take action.
Collateralized debt obligations, or CDOs, that were driving the housing market bubble were also identified as a key problem. Commissioner Byron Giorgio.
They took the BBB rated tranches, for the most part, of other mortgage-backed securities, which were the ones most likely to fail above equity. And by slicing and dicing them and putting them into another instrument called the collateralized debt obligation, they were then rated as super senior and received AAA ratings from the agencies. This is, a conundrum that we've variously labeled as alchemy or, you know, pejoratively in a variety of respects. But the point to be made is that this went on really without anybody questioning the fundamentals of how you could essentially turn, very risky securities into super safe securities simply by amalgamating them together. In fact, what those CDOs did is create layers of correlated risk when the notion was that somehow by putting them together, they were diversifying risk and making them stronger.
The commission said that in spite of some regulatory reforms, the financial system today is not much different to what it was just prior to the crisis. They hope that their report will be used as a guidepost for future regulation. But political will to enact the recommendations may be short in supply. All four Republican-appointed members on the Financial Commission declined to support the final report. Natural disasters continue to wreak havoc around the world. The Australian state of Victoria is waiting for a giant lake of floodwater, more than 50 miles long, according to some news reports, to hit towns in the southeast. Since December, more than 30 people have been killed in the country's worst flooding in a century. In Pakistan, the UN says more than 160,000 flood survivors remain in temporary camps, 6 months after flooding left more than 3 million people homeless. Sri Lanka and Brazil have also experienced massive, devastating floods. These and other natural disasters have caused a record number of deaths over the last year. According to the Center for Research on the Epidemiology of Disasters, more than 350 natural disasters killed almost 300,000 people in 2010. It's the worst year since the center started keeping records in 1988. Jocelyn Sambira from UN Radio has more.
The January earthquake in Haiti and the Russian summer heat wave led to most deaths, making 2010 the deadliest year in at least two decades. The Haiti deaths, estimated at 225,000, make up for two-thirds of the fatalities. Debarati Guha-Sapir, director of CREED, the Center for Research on the Epidemiology of Disasters at the University of Louvain, Belgium.
Really, the 2010 was an extremely, what we would call in French, meurtrier. It was really a year in which a lot of people died, but a very large proportion of the people who died were from, of course, the Haiti earthquake. So about two-thirds of this number, a little more than two-thirds of this number, came just from this one disaster.
Russia, number two on the list of lethal disasters, caused 56,000 deaths in the city of Moscow alone. China and Pakistan's natural disasters are also amongst the top 10 lethal disasters and rated as the most costly. The figures are bad, says Margareta Wallström, UN Special Representative for Disaster Reduction, not only in terms of people killed, but also in terms of economic losses.
Disasters are hitting all countries. You've seen it this year. Australia, rich, well prepared, but still overtaken by major events, and it is still continuing. Last year started equally horribly with the earthquake in Haiti, and it never stopped. Between earthquakes and floods, rich and poor countries, middle-income countries, no one is excluded from the impact of extreme events these days.
What the disaster data shows, adds Wallström, is that we should be better prepared for these emergencies.
If you want to save lives, you have to be prepared. You cannot consider a disaster, something that happens once, and then you continue your life and you get very surprised when it happens next time. No. It's also about people understanding and realizing that the risk also affects me. Secondly, the entire country, the community, the city are prepared to act on early warning signals. That's the way you save lives. You also save lives through a better infrastructure. The state of repair or disrepair of the infrastructure is really critical.
It's not the earthquakes that kill people, notes Wallström. It's the collapsing infrastructure that does.
That was Jocelyn Sambira from UN Radio. You're listening to FSRN. And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp and Jess Burns. Our technical producer at KPFA in Berkeley is Scott Pham. Thanks to KPFA, Nathan Moore, Julie Alexander, the FSRN Board and Steering Committee, and many others for relentless work to make sure FSRN stays on the air. For more information on how you can support FSRN, go to our website, fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.